how to be an adult in faith and spirituality. I believe your homework last week was to read chapters 1 and 2. Did you all do that?
Yes, sir.
2 and 3.
So obviously, yeah.
I was just testing you. Okay. With that, we'll let Dave get started. David?
Welcome, everyone. And it was chapters 2 and 3. So, one of the things we had talked about was to have you share some reflections about what you read. So if you have something you'd like to share or anything that came up from the reading, why don't we start that way?
One of the things you said last week was in reference to the study and the discussion that we are on a journey and a quest. And I thought about this in terms of myself, and it came to me that for me, this is in large part a hobby. Being here is a hobby. The reading is a hobby. It's fun. It's interesting. It's a hobby like people enjoy fishing, or people enjoy the arts, or they enjoy collecting antiques. And I don't mean to underplay its importance, because I think for me it's a journey and a quest too, but I think it's kind of interesting to reframe it as a hobby. And I haven't really thought that all the way through yet, but it... when you think of it as a hobby, it kind of lightens it up a little bit.
Yes.
It lets a life and death matter. And so I kind of enjoy the idea of it being a hobby. And I think, I'm guessing for a lot of people here, it's a kind of a hobby too.
Thank you. That was a very good comment. I like it. And you're right, we want to keep it on a lighter level. It's not like a heaven and hell orientation that we were brought up with. Other comments? Other? Yes.
Something that I read on page 58 at the bottom. We are neuralizing.
At the bottom, hold it one sec. Let's all find it. 58 at the bottom. This is our textbook. It's How to Be Adults in Faith and Spirituality. It's on the table if you still need one. And
we are neurologically built to feel compassion and to experience connection with one another, limitless numbers of others. Even without the advice of spiritual masters, we would have been kind, an indicator of how truly innate our goodness is. And it's wonderful to hear and read and understand this, because for so long we were sinners. You know, we required confession, we required repentance, we required we weren't always good. We were not taught that we were good. We were taught that there were things that were wrong with us that we had to correct and had to fix.
Yeah.
I like it that you said this.
Well, thank you. What a wonderful point. And I didn't even think of that. That, yeah, we were brought up to believe we're sinners and we better do all the things that we're supposed to do. Otherwise, we're going to be completely lost. And this begins with the original blessing idea instead of the original sin idea. Hi, Barbara.
I really liked the analysis you did, or synopsis, on page 38 of concepts that are true in religion, period.
Mm-hmm.
All religions. I thought that was really great extrapolation of what religions can and have said about themselves.
Yes. She's referring to the list of characteristics of gods throughout the ages, and so many of them are carried over into the Christian tradition. And this is because these realizations about divinity have an archetypal meaning. In other words, they're deeply in the inner life of all of us. And when we describe the characteristics of gods, we're actually talking about our own ultimate potentials. So we're not supposed to take it literally. So for instance, it says, gods can and do become human and incarnate themselves. This has something to do with how our basic nature has a divine element in it. And we are all here as incarnations. So the more we appreciate that, we see the bigness of our humanity. Good. Somebody else? Yes, how do you?
Lately, I've been doing some reading. I keep running across this sort of attitude that religion and its human expression and human way of putting it into practice is just a great hindrance. We just got to get rid of it because it holds us back from real spirituality. And what I like here is, no, they're both part of our being human.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always limitations to being human, but we don't throw it all out. So I found your writing on that very encouraging to me.
Well, thank you, Dee. That means a lot coming from you. And we'll be talking about that today, that these, it's not as if we're trying to put down religion or say it isn't important, because it has a lot to do with how we remain in contact not only with one another, but with something in ourselves that is continually evolving into more. And religion does help us get there. So we'll be talking about how to appreciate religion in an adult and healthy way. Other comments? Yes. Hi. What's your first name again?
Mike. Thanks. It's kind of a big thing, and you probably have covered it and I've missed it, but if somebody said to me, what do I need to be saved for? Or what's this salvation thing?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how to answer that for myself or for that person. It's a mystery to me what's wrong with me that I need to be saved. Saved means to me kind of like I need to be fixed. You want to comment on that?
Yes. I'm glad you brought it up. So this relates to what you brought up also. That originally, let's say in our childhood catechism, most of us were taught that we're so caught up in sin, and we were born with original sin, and that we were cleansed of that at baptism. But we still have a disordered nature that moves in the direction of vices, and so we're continually in need of some kind of discipline that will move us away from our inclination toward doing what is wrong or unacceptable, so that we can do what is considered right or good. And it certainly is true that humans have a light side and a dark side, but they're meant to be held together so that we can gain whatever creative possibilities are in them, rather than eliminate one in favor of the other. So salvation was thought of as basically what happens to you after you die, you will be saved, you will go to heaven because you died in a state of grace, as opposed to died in a state of sin. And now with this new understanding of theology, we're thinking more cosmically, we're thinking of all of us in this together rather than the individual salvation. We're thinking of how we all work together so that this whole human race can evolve in the direction of justice, peace, and love. I'm quoting the liturgy of Christ the King. Mm-hmm. But this is the kind of kingdom that we're here to produce, and salvation is about how to save all of us from hatred, injustice, inequality, and violence. So this is what I would see as a healthier way of looking at what it means to be saved. Does this make sense to everybody? Yes?
I love what you're saying about the dark and the light are to be held together in a balance. And I have a very personal disclosure, but it's so perfect to what you're saying.
Okay.
My parents both took their own lives, and I've been at the Tomb of Resurrection in Israel and was at the March on Washington and heard Martin Luther King. And both of those extremes of dark and light have created have merged into a creative energy in me that is unstoppable.
Mm. Well, thank you, Andy.
And joy.
Good.
Mm.
Well, I'm glad you could share that. Also, I want to go back to what you brought up last time, because I didn't know if I gave a good answer when you brought up the comments about the statement by Thomas Jefferson.
Yes.
I have sworn on the altar of God an eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man.
Yes.
And by the way, I first saw that quote at the same demonstration you're describing. Mm-hmm. And during this visit there to Washington, I went to the Jefferson Memorial, and those words are inscribed all the way around the little shrine where his statue's in the middle, and then that quote is up on top. So I copied it out, and I started my sermon that next Sunday with those words. So there was silence in the congregation. They had never heard anything like that before. But anyway, that energy of taking a stand against something, I thought Joanna gave a good answer, that we're always placing ourselves in the position where we're working in favor of the... If you can shut your cell phones, that would help. Well, it's turned into a horror movie. Anyway, it's always the combination of taking a stance but doing it in a heart-centered way. So when she gave the quotation from the Bhagavad Gita, the great scripture of Hinduism, that I do all I can to enter into the battle, but I'm always humbly at the feet of Krishna. In other words, I'm always devoted to the source of goodness while at the same time taking my stand against the forces of injustice and in favor of the forces of justice. Okay, other, Jim?
I don't know if it was here or just one other book that I have read that Martin Luther King made a very profound statement that more darkness cannot drive out the darkness. Only light can do that. So the way that you engage in the battle is important. Mm-hmm. You can do it with darkness or you can do it with light. Mm-hmm. And that mm-hmm. is
yes.
very
mm-hmm. mm-hmm. Experiencing power outages while a wildfire is threatening is frightening. I felt I could do all right knowing I might have to evacuate any time or any day as long as the lights were on. Mm-hmm. But when the lights went out, mm-hmm. I changed completely. I became mm-hmm. very terrified.
Mm-hmm. Alice?
I really liked the section on the religion of patriotism because it's...
What page are you on?
Well, 41. There's just one sentence that... it's the second paragraph. Healthy adult patriotism is fidelity to one's homeland with keen interest in and questioning of its policies. And this whole section... really intersected with my distress over the recent response to the killing of Osama bin Laden and the even from our government. Never before have I seen the American government condone in such an upfront way the killing mm-hmm. of another human being, to take him out and to say justice is served. It's bothersome to me. It doesn't mm-hmm. seem to represent me and the aspirations I have as an American for what it means to be an American, but even beyond that, for what it means to be human. And I think something of the soul of humanity is being lost here. And right away I thought about the years when our children were young. Our first friends here in Santa Barbara were Jewish, and we always went to their home to celebrate the Seder with them. And I was always very impressed with the Seder meal, especially making the connections with the Last Supper. But I was really impressed, and I brought the book, and I always say the book because it's so much of this ritual is meaningful. But at one part in the ritual, they have a full cup, and it recounts the 10 plagues. And this is what they say. And it's not inclusive language, but you get the idea, the response to injustice. When men defy the will of God, they bring pain and suffering upon themselves. God's law aims for the welfare and happiness of all mankind. To deny his law and to do evil brings destruction upon those who perpetrate it. When Pharaoh defied the command of God to release the Jewish people, he invited adversity upon himself and his own people. Though the plagues were visited upon the Egyptians for the result of their own evil, we do not rejoice over their downfall and defeat. Judaism regards all men as children of God, even enemies who seek to destroy our people. When, for the sake of our welfare, they met with suffering and death, we mourn their loss and express sorrow over their destruction. A full cup is the symbol of complete joy. Though we celebrate the triumph of our sacred cause, our happiness is not complete so long as others had to be sacrificed for its sake. We shall therefore diminish the wine in our cups as we recall the plague visited upon the Egyptians to give expression to our sorrow over the losses which each plague exacted. And then we go through each one and dip our finger in the cup and put a dot on the plate. I mean, it's this approach. I mean, we do live in a world in the process of becoming, and so these things are happening, but to rejoice and celebrate, it goes against the grain, in my mind, of the gospel and what it means not to just be an American, to be human, to be Christian.
I thought that too.
I really like this.
I'm so glad you wrote this up. And what a beautiful quotation. That person, the person who wrote that, really got it. It's not about we're right, they're wrong, we're rejoicing because they are defeated. It's a compassionate sorrow that any defeat had to happen while we are rejoicing that our cause is, has been has triumphed. At the same time, we're sorry for all the pain that was part of the process.
Where is this in Judaism today, or in the whole Palestinian-Israel conflict? You don't, this seems to have disappeared.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like a special gift that some people have to love in that unconditional and universal way. But I believe it's possible for all of us.
Yes.
And what a wonderful calling that would be.
Mm-hmm.
I want to become the kind of person who sees the world like that, instead of the one who's still caught in the triumphalism and it doesn't matter who gets destroyed in the process. Yes.
Part of the non-duality.
Yes, right.
Talking about that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. So as long as we're caught in the dualism, the what's right and what's wrong, who is right and who is wrong, who are our enemies, who are our friends, it just doesn't really work. Reminds me of that statement that's right at the end of Romeo and Juliet. Where be these enemies? Look how heaven found ways to kill your joys with love. In other words, he's talking to the parents of Romeo and Juliet who were lying there dead. And he says, you know, because of all this conflict and feuding that you two families engaged in, this is the result. You lost your children.
Mm-hmm.
Look how heaven found ways to kill your joys with love.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that's the sorrowful result of that dualistic style. And our religion was not presented in a non-dualistic way. Because even when they were saying, we're the true religion, and you're not allowed to go into other people's churches because that's sinful or that's not real, they were programming us toward the dualism that we're now trying to free ourselves from. Yes.
Well, you kind of said it, and I was thinking St. Paul said it first, love never fails. And I think that's the answer. You know, it's the answer to relationships. There's always misunderstandings of relationships. And so if you go there, people melt, you know,
mm-hmm.
with that return of love.
Yeah.
And that one.
Good. Thank you. Yes.
Dave, I
had, hi, Mary.
Hi. I had two thoughts.
Yeah.
I really appreciate what Alice read. And yet, when Saddam Hussein was executed by his own people, I don't remember a similar outcry by government or by the people of the United States, which includes us. And my second kind of thought was, I think what you read about Thomas Jefferson is quite lovely. On the other hand, he impregnated a slave woman and never acknowledged the child or the woman.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one thing to have words around a building.
So I guess we'll have to say nobody's perfect.
I mean, I think there are ideals to be lived towards,
yeah.
But I think we also need to look at the reality of the life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he didn't have that other kind of consciousness. Consciousness didn't extend to all people. such as the slaves.
You know, I think this is so great when we can all sit here and listen to different points of view, because there's probably more than one point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the Jewish people used to, I forget the name they called it, but to get a fuller sense of reality, they would come and talk and argue, but not at each other, but argue a point. And I guess my point is, it's one thing to sit in a room and discuss theology and theory, but if you've lost loved ones or someone at the tower, you might have a different feeling inside, a human feeling, and you know, you might have to go through a process of healing. So it's easy for us on the West Coast. We weren't there, and maybe some of you were, and I wasn't there. So I can't comprehend, but I remember that day. So all I'm saying is, there's a time we're not going to, I can't go around and be all pacifist in my mind all the time. You know, like, I mean, I'd like to be, but I'm not there yet.
That's why it's a journey.
Yeah.
Okay. Way in the back.
When you're talking about duality, I was just wondering, this is a question, the duality that we have within us. You wrote this book, The Shadow Den, where we have to sort of accept our shadow side, our dark side. Does that start with a sort of acceptance of that? Because that's a duality in itself, the shadow side and the light within us. Is that a form of duality as well? Doesn't it start right in here?
Yes, that's a good point. It's not duality in the sense of total division, because they keep moving back and forth, the light and the dark. But we have many energies inside of us, and the work is always continually to integrate them in some way so that we pull together the disparate parts and they all work in one direction. What is this one direction? To create a kingdom of justice, peace, and love in the outside world, and in our inner world, to create the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, the courage to change the things we can, and the wisdom to know the difference. This is our ultimate purpose. Yes.
That last comment, it occurs to me, if you get enough light coming from enough angles, you can make the shadow go away.
Well, this is an important point, this whole idea of the shadow, and we will talk more about it in another chapter when we talk about going into the void, the dark side of faith, when you have doubt and nothing seems to work anymore. That formerly, instead of acknowledging our own dark side or light side, we personify the light side, the angels, versus the dark side, which are the demons. So you have St. Michael leading the forces of light and Lucifer leading the forces of darkness. And we want to watch out that when we looked at that model, we were not projecting the light outside of ourselves or the darkness outside of ourselves. So that we gave it a name, like Michael and Lucifer, instead of saying, I want to see the part of me that will not serve, and the part of me that is willing to serve. So St. Michael is willing to serve, and Lucifer will not serve. But these are really qualities in our own psyche. And these names, Lucifer and Michael, are personifications of something that people have noticed about themselves all the way back from the beginning of history. We've always noticed that we had an inclination toward the dark and toward the light. Mm-hmm. But it could be so uncomfortable to hold both of those together that we split them and then projected them outside ourselves and said, oh, Lucifer, Satan, the devil, this is the darkness. And you can put Osama bin Laden and Hitler and so forth. And as long as we're doing that, we're in danger of never knowing ourselves, let alone taking responsibility for our part in everything. Does this make sense to everybody?
Mm-hmm.
Hi, Jenny.
David, it reminds me of that expression. I can't remember just exactly what years it was, but it was common to say, with kind of a joke, the devil made me do it.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, and we had the image of the guardian angels on one side telling you the right way to go, and the devils on the other side. Which one are you going to listen to?
The gospel of Cliff Wilson.
And see how these all, they split off and they separate what is meant to be all one experience. What experience is that? Being human on this planet. Okay, any other reflections or comments before we continue? Oh, yes, Annie.
I found for me that's why it's so important to stay in the moment and to listen, because I am all that.
Yes, I am all that. Right.
Of responding in a wide variety of ways.
Yes.
So I have to pay attention which one's appropriate for now.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Good point. What I especially like about this discussion we've just been having is it brought me back to when I was first ordained, and when I would be teaching a class, the questions were, what does the church teach on this?
Mm-hmm.
What is the right way to look at this?
Mm-hmm.
And it's so wonderful to realize we're no longer there. It's not you asking somebody what's the right way to look at something. It's everybody sharing, and from the dialogue comes a sense of what fits for you.
Mm-hmm.
And we're listening to what the church has told us over the centuries. We're not shutting off that voice, but we're listening not as those who blindly follow every word that's said, but as those who receive it, look at it, hold it, work with it, and put it together with what comes from so many other traditions and experiences, and then seeing how it can work in the best interest of everyone. This is a whole new way of doing it, and it certainly is welcome, isn't it? It means a lot that we've come this far. Yes.
This is not something you need to go into length at the moment, but I have been interested in the fact that Buddhism has been a strong influence. You mentioned this.
Yep.
In the back cover or in the preface of the book, and it seems as if what we're saying about opposites here apply, because if you look at Christianity and Buddhism, they are totally opposite in so many ways. I mean, I can give you long lists of how they're opposite, and yet somehow for you, you've gone through a process where you have dealt with those opposites and integrated something that's meaningful for you, and the book is a product of that in part, although it's not evident the trail that you necessarily took to get where you are.
Be hard to describe it. Thank you. All right, well, let's take a look. We were on chapter 2. And by the way, to respond to that question about salvation, notice the quotation right at the beginning on page 26 from Carl Jung. If our religion is based on salvation, our chief emotions will be fear and trembling. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, am I going to be saved or not? Did I do the right thing? And if our religion is based on wonder, sense of mystery, our chief emotion will be gratitude. Mm-hmm. Isn't that a healthier way to look at it? Mm-hmm. So let's take a look at what we might consider the four basic elements that seem to characterize all religions. And this is somewhat in response to what he brought up. Religions the world over have something to do with beliefs. What do I believe beyond what can be proven? So right away we're in a realm of mystery because we are assenting, we are saying yes to teachings that we don't have a proof for. Religions offer a moral code. This is what's right and this is what's wrong. Third, religions have rituals. And finally, religions have devotion, some type of personal relationship with a divine source or divine being, something beyond our own ego. And these four elements are very visible in the religions that we were brought up with. So the beliefs speak to the intellect, the morality speaks to our will, the rituals speak to our behavior, and the devotion speaks to our emotions, four elements that seem to be present in our psychic world. We have a mind that can know things, so religion speaks to that mind with beliefs. We have a will that can take action, and that is where morality comes in. And we seem oriented toward showing what's going on with us or commemorating something through rituals. And we certainly have emotions such as love and passion, feelings. And these can be oriented toward realities beyond ourselves. It could be a person, it could be nature, just something that you feel devoted to. And at the same time, we notice that there are certain givens of life that humans have picked up on over the ages. One is that everything changes and ends. That things don't always go according to our plans, that life is not always fair, that pain is part of everyone's life, and that people are not loyal and loving all the time. There are sometimes we're not all. And most religions, in addition to having these four elements, have specific responses to these five givens of human existence. So, for instance, you can say, yes, it's true that everything changes and ends on this mortal plane, but there awaits us a heaven that is unchanging and that is eternal. As St. Paul says, When this earthly tent is folded up, there awaits us a tabernacle not made by hands. So we can be consoled by the realization that there's something in an afterlife that will balance out all the changes and endings that we've been through in the course of the last time. Secondly, things don't always go according to plans on this mortal plane, but there's a divine plan at work that cannot be upset by anything that people do. Thirdly, life is not always fair, but in the afterlife, there will be a judgment, and those who have obeyed God's commands will be saved, sent to heaven, and those who have not will be sent to hell, and those who still need something in between will be in purgatory. And it's all fairly set up. And pain is part of life, but the crucifix shows us that pain can be redemptive and make an important difference. And people are not loving and loyal all the time, but God is love unending. Now, our question here is, are we using religion so that we don't have to enter fully into what life is really about? So that we know we have something going for us that the rest of the world doesn't have. They're all at the mercy of changes and endings, but we have a heaven waiting for us where there'll be no more changes and no more endings. And if we're using it that way, then we want to question ourselves, because we're not making our full commitments to our life on earth, which is the life that we have right now. So, is there a way of working with these givens and accepting them and being okay with them? And it seems like one way to do this is to let yourself feel the grief that automatically goes with all of these. Of course, when there's an ending, you're going to feel sad and grieve for a while. And when plans that fall through, that leads to grief. When you notice things are unfair, that leads to grief, and so forth. Could it be that we're using some of our religious teachings so that we don't have to feel the full brunt of human grief? See what an important question that is? And it makes us understand why we're so attracted to the image of the Pietà, the Virgin Mary holding the dead body of Christ in such serene grief. And there's something about that picture which is so powerful in the human imagination. Everybody responds to it. You don't have to be a believer. You just look at that image and you know, oh, that is what it's about when you're a human who fully enters into the human story. That sometimes you'll be holding what you love the most and you'll be feeling the grief about how it has gone in some way. And that would be like a balance for the voices that say, well, none of this matters because we have something going for us in an afterlife. And the other part of it is that if the world is like this, and it certainly is, it certainly has givens like these, if, in addition to the grief, we could trust what? Trust that these must be the very ingredients that we need if we're ever to be people of character, depth, and compassion. Oh, so that's why it's like this. Because if it weren't like this, I would never be a person who could feel compassion for all the others who who suffer the same way. And I could never build a character that has depth in it. I would be a very superficial person if I lived in a world in which nothing ever changed. All my plans worked out perfectly. Everything was perfectly fair, etc. No pain. We wouldn't get our chance to expand into the fullness of our humanity that way. So it brings us to that question. Was our religion helping us expand to the full dimensions of our humanity? Did it really believe in the incarnation? Because as long as salvation is something waiting for us beyond the grave, rather than our calling to save the planet, as long as it's about that, then we're somehow still caught in the dualism. Does this make sense to everybody? Mm-hmm. Questions about this? Okay. Yes?
Don't we try to make laws to make things be fair?
Yes. We're trying to bring about justice in whatever way we can. But it's still a given that no matter what, we notice things are unfair in so many ways.
Meaning that as fair as you can make it, it's still not really fair.
Well, let's put it this way. I'm glad you brought this up, because I do want to give the kind of alternative style. Instead of saying, well, everything changes and ends here, but that doesn't matter because there's a paradise where things don't change, what if we were to say, everything is changing and ending, and I enter into that flow with continual facing of what is ready to be taken hold of, and continually letting go of what is ready to disappear. So I'm entering fully into the human story.
But how do we deal with the Lakers' loss? Is it
another enormous issue. So let me take that to the question you brought up about fairness. So everything changes and ends, and I have a program in me of grieving that can go with it. Things don't always go according to plans, but that might lead to things happening beyond my control, and I'll meet up with wonderful synchronicities, meaningful coincidences that bring about whole new prospects in life. People are not always fair, but I can always act fairly. Pain is part of life, and I can work with my pain to see how it can somehow lead to transformation. People are not loving and loyal all the time, but I can commit myself to being loving and loyal as much of the time as I can. These would be the healthy alternatives that turn the whole picture into a moral dedication, a new way of looking at morality. I'm acting fairly in a world of unfairness. No matter how unfair the rest of the world is, I've chosen to act fairly. And no matter how unloving and unloyal others may be, I'm committing myself to the opposite style. And that answers the question that was asked in the Gospel of St. Luke. Lord, what shall we do? In whatever situation I'm in asking then what can I do? If it's like this, what can I do? And our what can I do has beautiful answers like these that I just outlined. They give us the chance to evolve into the kind of people who work with the givens of life so creatively that they move the evolution along. Evolution of what? Evolution of ourselves into the full dimensions of what we have always been about. No limitations. No holding back. Jim?
There's the saying that life happens while we're making other plans.
They run something to the, I think it was Mother Teresa's prayer, that I'll paraphrase it. It says, it wasn't my turn to take out the garbage, but take the garbage out anyway.
Mm-hmm.
See the whole list of things.
Good. Other, yes?
Hi. You had said grief, it's like a hole in our life. It presents itself as a hole, and to me, that the picture I had was that a hole, and that's a vacuum in which grace can come in.
Andrew? We're grieving for what's missing and or what we've lost, and when we respond that way, we're going with what our psyche is set up to do. And so whenever you're doing that, grace comes to help us. As St. Thomas says, grace fills on nature. Okay, so we're going to take a break very shortly, but let's take a look at one last point. Over on page 34, if you look at that second paragraph, and I'm going down toward the end. I'm making a distinction about Revelation, that it can be thought of as exclusive. There's only one objective truth and only one true religion that preserves it. Inclusive style is there's some truth in all religion, but these truths are only foreshadowing of the full truth that is found in the one true religion. So some of us heard that. And then finally, the universal approach. Truth emerges from the ongoing dialogue of all religions and philosophical traditions. In this view, Revelation is not limited to a single configuration of truth, but a continual revelation throughout time with ever-changing formulations that have to make sense to each new generation. No single church has a stranglehold on this kind of truth. Faith, from this perspective, is a relationship to the divine, and beliefs are ever more recognizable symbols through which faith is manifest. And then this last sentence, do I believe because of what they say, or do they say what I believe? See the difference in that? Because we all started with, I have to believe what they say. And we've made a wonderful transition. Are they saying what I intuitively, through prayer and contemplation, have come to realize, and what I've tested out in dialogue with other people whom I trust, is what they're saying reflecting that? If it is, then it really fits for me. And if it doesn't, I have to keep questioning. Judy?
I'm grateful for your mindfulness about putting before us that a lot of our lives have been lived towards the response of living in the assent to the beliefs we've been given. And in the new now, I'm aware that the beliefs are simply pointers toward the truth. and it is toward, it is the truth to which I must make my fundamental assent.
Yes, I'm making my sense of the true, ultimate truth to which these teachings are pointing, rather than to the teachings themselves. So I'm no longer stopping at the teaching them.
And that truth is in me.
Yeah, and of course, where that truth will ultimately be found is in the indwelling spirit. What is this indwelling spirit? It's the Holy Spirit alive in every one of us equally, just waiting to be set free to take full flight into all the truths that it wants to manifest. Okay, so let's take a short break and then we'll come back.